I'm delighted now to welcome Sandra Blakesley and George Johnson. They are both New York Times science writers. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So, let's talk for a moment about the Science Writing Workshop. What's that all about and how did it come about?
Yeah, this is actually our 15th year, which is amazing to think about. And I was just counting in my head when I came over here and realized we've had more than 600 people go through the workshop, about 40 to 45 a year. And every year, Sandy and I, we invite like three of our friends and colleagues in science writing to also be instructors. So we have the Jamie Shreve, the science editor for National Geographic magazine, Daniel Engber, the science editor for Slate, the online publication, and Frank Clifford, a fellow Santa Fean who just retired as the environment editor of the Los Angeles Times. And, you know, we teach people about communicating science in an artful way to the public.
And so it's a very important thing and a very tricky thing because there is a huge gap between the language that scientists use and the language that the rest of us use, and in large part, a large gap between the concepts they use and those that we know as well.
Absolutely. So it's kind of like a full employment act, although I must say that the news media are in free fall right now. But what we do is translate science, and it's you have to kind of learn the vocabulary, and not just the words and the jargon they use, but you also have to learn how to bring the concepts down to a lay level. And most scientists can't do that. They're terrible at writing. So we just take their ideas and put it into accessible language and tell stories and put it in newspapers or books.
A lot of it is about telling stories, except they're true stories. And I consider myself really a nonfiction writer who happens to have settled into writing about science. And I feel like we have an advantage. I mean, a scientist has an advantage when they write about science, like when Brian Greene writes about string theory, because he knows this thoroughly inside and out, and he's one of the few scientists who's able to step back and write about it in a pretty, you know, for a pretty general audience. But I think we both think of ourselves as being on the side of the reader, so we're kind of going out there and finding out what's interesting and what piques our curiosity, and then we come back and write articles and books about it and try to build a readership.
Are you both scientists at all by training? Do you have any science background?
Nope, 40 years of writing about science, so we know a lot. Well, I've been doing it for 40 years.
Yeah, I thought I wanted to be a scientist when I went to college at the University of New Mexico, and I actually thought I wanted to be a physicist, and I took some introductory physics classes, and I realized what I really liked was more like the big general ideas. Like I wanted to learn about quantum mechanics and relativity, and then they had you starting with 17th century Newtonian physics, and I realized that by the time I actually got to what I was going to be interested in, I would be, a PhD physicist. And I decided instead to start reading about these things on my own and reading really good popular science, some written by scientists, some by people like I became, who were, writers who concentrate on this subject.
It's interesting because a lot of our students come from bench science. They have gotten their PhD. They're sitting there in the lab and they're running slides or they're doing genetics, and they are really, really bored. And they realize that they've focused in so narrowly in order to get that degree that that's not what they want to do anymore. So a good chunk of our students come to explore science writing. We only have a week, so we really can't give a writing course where we would just rip people's copy to shreds and teach them that way. But we give them kind of a good insight to what that career is like, or what it was like, because we really come out of classical mainstream media print, and that world is changing right now dramatically. And there's no really clear answer where the news media are going yet. But one of the pieces of advice that I've been seeing for young writers is to build a brand. Have somebody support you while you get into freelancing and see where it goes. Because nobody really knows. And this is true for all journalism, but science writing too. We're just one niche.
Well, major newspapers have cut their science sections altogether.
That's right.
Oh, many of them, yes. Fortunately, not the New York Times, right, which still employs more science writers and puts out more well-done words on science every week than probably any publication.
But it's it's the last man standing, really.
Yeah, except that, now there's all these other new outlets. So I'm really kind of an optimist. I mean, as the world becomes increasingly more complex, there's going to be increased demand for people who are able to come at a complex subject, learn it, and write it and translate it in a way that a that a reader can, you're not only imparting knowledge, but, you know, in a way that's really going to hook them into reading for entertainment, but then, I mean, it's sort of like intellectual entertainment almost what we do, is what we do, except you're imparting things that are true.
Well, and it's also important because it helps us understand the world around us, and there are some major issues like climate change and species extinction and the health or toxicity of various consumer goods in our environment and things like that, which if we fail to understand them at our peril.
That's right.
Yeah, I wanted to mention my first, I studied journalism at the University of New Mexico, and one of my teachers was Tony Hillerman, the mystery writer who died last year, and he taught this class that really, really affected me, and he's had us start out by reading people like Tom Wolfe and Hunter Thompson and what they called the new journalists then, and he really impressed us with the fact that a really good nonfiction writer can use the same techniques as a really good novelist as far as painting characters, you know, with literary brushstrokes and plotting, you know, little stories. But the difference is that it has to absolutely strictly be true. You know, you can't decide it would be nice to say your scientist, you know, has a red tie when he's actually not wearing a tie. I mean, all those details have to be true, but you can still structure them into an artful way that is very much a satisfying read as good fiction. So,
now, what is the role of storytelling in science writing? I mean, obviously you have to tell stories in order to keep people hooked, but does science lend itself to narrative storytelling?
A lot of it does. There's two really types of science writing. One is just straight news reporting. Mm. So such that you have a synthetic genome built yesterday, and that you really can't get into the storytelling of that.
Right.
But you can do magazine pieces or longer pieces or profiles. There's a lot of different ways to write the same story. In fact, anytime you're reporting a story, you'll get this huge bolus of information, enormous, and you have to throw out about 90% of what you know and put it into a linear storyline. Now, it can be, like George is saying, it can be storytelling, it can be very artful, or it could just be straight news, wham, bam, thank you, here it is, and profiles,
too.
Yeah,
but very clear.
Very clear,
I mean,
right.
There's a huge art in just the clarity.
Right.
Well, and also I would think that because a lot of what you're writing about is really complicated, and there's a lot of the concept is not universally true, but it's in this case, so it's in the brains of a certain kinds of rats, and people love to extrapolate that stuff and think that it's, so you have to be very clear and limiting without being ridiculously didactic and scientific sounding in your prose.
Right. So one of the things I realized in teaching science writing, and because we only teach once a year, so it's not something that
we're not teachers by trade or instinct.
But I think I only want to impart one thing to my students, and that is to think. Before they sit down to write, you have to think, and you have to know what you want to say. You can't just, a lot of high school writing teachers will say, well, just start writing and it'll come out all right. Well, that's just not true. You have to really think hard about what you want to say and why it's important and who cares. And once you sort of get that in your mind, then the story will write.
We're talking to Sandra Blakeslee and George Johnson, science writers who are with the New York Times and writers of many books. One of the things that you've written about, George, is the perhaps similarities in impulse between science and religion.
Yeah, I wrote a book. God, it's been so many years, I hate to think about it, but it was called Fire in the Mind, and the subtitle was Science, Faith, and the Search for Order. And it's actually set in this area, and between kind of a literary conceit that I used was that the four sacred mountains of the Tewa Indians, like at San Ildefonso Pueblo, define this region where there are all these different ways of perceiving the world, ranging from the science like going on at places like the Santa Fe Institute and Los Alamos Laboratories and the School for Advanced Research to the Tewa Indian religion itself and the penitentes up in Truchas. So I actually put all of these into this big stew and kind of used it as a means of talking about, you know, the differences and similarities between explaining the world by science and explaining it through mythology or religion and what that can tell us about just this human impulse we have to find order in the world, and how we know when we're actually finding real orders, and how we know when, as opposed to imposing false ones, which is, you know, often the case with religion.
And there's also this, the fact that it is a human impulse. I often think about when we are making order, is this a fundamentally human thing, or does that order exist beyond our existence?
Well, the brain actually seeks correlation. There's a lot of neuroscience, and I'm writing a book right now on magic in the brain, and it's called Sleights of Mind, and I'm writing it with two neuroscientists, and we're working with Penn and Teller and all these really top magicians in Las Vegas.
Like literally magic show magic.
Yeah, right, magicians and con men too. I'm writing about con men right now this morning. But we have all these illusions. The brain has, you know, visual illusions and cognitive illusions, and one of the cognitive illusions is about correlation and causation. And it's just that's what the brain does. It automatically correlates whether it's true or not. And we're fated to do that. There's the gambler's fallacy, which is really interesting. If you throw heads 12 times and tails 12 times, would that be random or not? When people, if they're gambling, they will always, you know, kind of wait for the, they'll put money on the tails coming up after all the heads, because it has to be, well, it's still a 50-50 chance. Every toss is 50-50.
Right. Yeah, so you're sitting at the slot machine thinking, well, you know, it's not paying off, so it's got to be building up this force that's going to make it pay off.
But it's your brain that's doing that, and it's an illusion. It's a corollary illusion.
Yeah.
So it's we're fated to be screwed.
and the great thing about Sandy's book is she's showing how magicians actually have learned instinctively a lot of the things that the neuroscientists have learned through their science.
Right. For attention and awareness, they manipulate your attention. And the neuroscientists can't do that. And the neuroscientists have all these fancy experiments in their labs, and they fail. And then they realize, my God, these magicians are getting up there every night in front of hundreds of people, carrying these tricks off again and again and again and again, and nobody ever sees what they're doing. And so how do they do it? So they've been studying the magicians, and the magicians are, some of them, like Teller, is very, very interested in the neuroscience, and he's willing to talk about it. Some of them are a little bit, you know, these are our secrets. But you know what I found out? That every single magic trick that these magicians want to keep secret is on YouTube. And very often it's like a 7-year-old in his bedroom with his dad holding the camera, and he's doing, oh, here's the salt shaker trick. And so, you know, so there's no secrets at all.
There's YouTube, there's really
it's really fun.
Well, another correlation is between science and, I don't know if I want to say art or just beauty. There's so much in science, whether it's the visual images that come from intense microscopy or biology or whatever, that are so beautiful to human beings.
Right. Yeah, and NSF has a contest for that, and National Academy, too. There's a lot of that online. You can look up visual imagery. And every year, Science Magazine has a visual imagery contest.
Right.
Beautiful images, and not just microscopy, but deep space, and that's art. I mean, it affects our aesthetics. But to know it's real is even cooler.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And it makes you think about what the neural roots of art might be.
Mm. Yeah. Right. Well, there are a lot, and aesthetics. There's a whole field of neuroaesthetics right now. Actually, there's neuromagic, and there's neuroeconomics, and there's neuro this, neuro that. So it's a little bit overdone, but it's fascinating. I've been writing about neuroscience for about 25 years, and I was probably one of the first people in the mid-80s to really start covering the field, and I've watched it burgeon. And philosophers have been sort of booted out of the way, I think, by neuroscience, because it's more that you can have the tools now to really dig into the brain and to look at the cogs and the wheels and pop the hood. There are neuroscience is answering a lot of those questions about how we believe, how we plan, how we think, how we pay attention. So it's the most interesting, I think, area of science. Although physics is cool too, but anyways, but it's really on a rampant, wonderful, you know.
It's probably the most wide open as far as, I mean, we're still so far from having a sense of how the brain works.
And, right.
You know, just this morning, I do this approximately monthly show on the internet called Science Saturday on bloggingheads.tv, and I do it with John Horgan, who's an old science writing friend, and we were talking about this project by this IBM scientist who's just claimed to have simulated a cat's brain, neuron by neuron, and then one of his detractors, who's doing his own simulations, is saying, there's no way this is even close to the complexity of a cat's brain. You haven't even got an ant's brain.
Yeah, right.
But then he has his own project called the Blue Brain Project, in which he's simulating neurons down to the level of actually the ionic current, so like inside the neurons, and then the whole question is, what you can learn from that.
And much detail, I don't
think. Yeah, I mean, you can get swamped by the details, right. So sometimes it's better just to abstract upward.
Sandra Blakeslee and George Johnson are New York Times science writers. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.